April the 7th, Rwandans began the 30th Kwibuka, the annual commemoration of the 1994 genocide in which 800,000 people, most of them from the Tutsi ethnic group, were killed by Hutu militias. For more on what this 100-day period means for the genocide survivors, I reached Konsole Nishimwe, author of the autobiography Tested to the Limit, a genocide survivor's story of pain, resilience, and hope. She tells me that Kwibuka, a Kinyarwanda word that means to remember, is a time to honor the memory of those who lost their lives during the genocide and to reflect on the importance of reconciliation and the prevention of such atrocities in the future. Konsole Nishimwe, thank you so much for joining us today on The Voice of America. Now, reflecting on the events of 30 years ago, could you describe what life was like for you and your family leading up to the genocide?
Thank you so much for having me. As we commemorate the 1994 genocide against the Tutsi 30 years ago, as a survivor, it feels like, you know, it happened yesterday. So for me, I was a young 14 years old around that time who was happy living with my both parents. And I lived in a western province of the country and where I grew up around that time. And I would say that my childhood was a beautiful childhood, but unfortunately everything changed that I found myself and my family going to hiding for 3 months, where I had to face unimaginable horrors at that young age and losing the people that I loved and see things that, any person, I would never wish for anybody to see in their life. So I lost a big family and so many horrible things happened to me at that time. So,
How did the genocide directly impact you and your loved ones? How could you share some of the most challenging moments you experienced during that time?
During that period, during the 3 months in hiding, I had to be forced going into hiding, like I said earlier. And during that period, the people who are considered to be friends and people that I used to see, you know, going around and, you know, going to school, my parents being teachers, going to teach their family, their children. So my dad was murdered. My three younger brothers were also slaughtered, and their bodies were thrown in a septic tank of our home. Like many of the people know that during the genocide against the Tutsi, rape was used as a weapon. And as a young woman at the time, it was not easy to escape that. So I had to, you know, I faced that. I was raped, and like many other young girls and women, those are the most horrible, some of the most horrible things that I had to face during the genocide against the Tutsi.
And in the aftermath of the genocide, what were some of the immediate challenges that you faced as a survivor? How did you and your family begin to rebuild your lives?
After surviving the genocide, losing the people that I loved, my dad, my three younger brothers, and what happened to me, I lived with the consequences and the trauma, you know, being a young teenager. It was not easy to go back to a normal life. I had to relive every day the images of the things that I've gone through, the nightmares, a big part of my family was murdered. So both sides on my mom and my dad. Thankfully my mom survived with me and my sister. So I'm one of the few survivors who have a parent. At least, you know, I can lean on her shoulder, despite the fact she carried a lot of trauma herself. But at least, you know, we resumed life together. She went back to teach. I went back to school, carrying so much pain within. But at the same time, I, like any other survivor, I had to, you know, keep you moving on and trying the best I could to start a new life. Even though it was not very easy.
Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And you've shown remarkable resilience in the face of unimaginable trauma. Can you share some of the strategies of carping for you, mechanisms that have helped you navigate the long journey of healing and recovery?
You know, as a young person, of course, who was carrying so much pain within, I hoped that as the time went on, maybe one day I'll wake up not feeling pain and not feeling what I was feeling within. At the time, you know, some of the consequences that I found, you know, because of rape, I found that I was HIV positive, which was a constant reminder for what happened to me. So, but one of the things that helped me the most is to never give up. So I looked around myself. I found so many survivors who carried so much pain, who carried a lot of, you know, even went through worse I went through, but at the same time, I was carrying so much within myself. So one of the things that helped me is to go to therapy, which is something that I found later on in my life at that time. It took me many years to be able to do that. So, and when I did therapy, it also allowed me to write my book, which is something that helped me so much because I had to go deep within and talk about the most painful things, especially rape, which was one of the hardest things for me to talk about. Even though I went through so much pain of losing people that I loved, but rape was one of the hardest things for me to even talk about. Mm. But when I had the courage to talk about it, you know, because of therapy, it was so cathartic for me. So, and I started that journey, and it felt like a load was lifted off my shoulder. So that's how my life journey of healing began, and I started to feel like life was worth living.
Right.
Even though it was not easy journey, but I felt like life was worth living, and I was able to think of others who carry so much pain like what I was carrying. That's why I decided to start talking about it. So,
Right. And what role has forgiveness played in your healing process? Have you been able to forgive those who perpetrated this violence against you and your family?
For me, I believe that forgiveness is the best thing you can do for your own well-being. It's not about the perpetrator. It's about your own well-being. For me, when I allow myself to go deep within, going through the journey of healing, forgiveness also is a part of it. So for me to find a positive outlook on life, I had to allow myself to, you know, to do that so that I can live a healthy and fulfilling life. So it's an individual journey, but for me, it really helped me so much to embrace life, to even find positive things in life. So,
And you chose to share your story with the world in your book, Tested to the Limit. I remember we talked about this many years ago when it first came out. Talk to us a little bit about how your decision to speak about your experiences as a genocide survivor. Why did you decide to write this book?
When I decided to write my book, at first it was my journey of healing. So it was more of helping myself to begin my journey of healing. But at the same time, when I finished writing my book, I decided to share it with the world for others so that my fellow survivors also can have encouragement to share their own stories as well. So it was not only for my own well-being to be able to begin my healing journey. It was also to help my fellow survivors share their stories, but at the same time also it had gone through during the 1994 genocide against the Tutsi, and also to make sure that the memories of my loved ones remain alive and not forgotten. So
Now it's been 30 years. It's unbelievable to think about, you know, many of these images and memories are still very much alive in people like yourself who survived the genocide. 30 years later, how do you feel about the progress Rwanda has made in the past 30 years in terms of reconciliation, in terms of justice and rebuilding? Are there any areas where you believe more work is needed?
As a survivor, I'm really amazed to see where my country is and the progress we have made, because we have gone through unimaginable horrors. The country was completely destroyed. To see the country rebuilding itself, and everybody was involved, and to see everyone being happy and the country safe, and really it's a remarkable to see that. And I, as a survivor, I'm really happy to be able to see this happening. But at the same time, healing is a journey for, you know, a country that have gone through unimaginable horrors. A lot of people carry so much, so much within themselves. The trauma is real. So, and for me, I believe that, you know, healing will take, you know, a long time for, you know, for people individually. So I believe that that is very normal. So to me, I believe that, you know, where we are is amazing, but we need to continue making sure that we minimize also the intergenerational trauma, because trauma, we realize that when you carry so much within, you can give it to your...
And pass it on.
You can pass it on. So right. I believe that in terms of trauma healing, it's a journey. So and I'm happy we also working on it. So mm-hmm. Yeah.
and looking ahead, what message would you like to convey to future generations of Rwanda and in the world about the importance of, you know, remembrance? In Rwanda it's called Kwibuka, reconciliation and preventing atrocities like the genocide from happening again.
To young people, I believe my message, make sure you educate yourself about what happened, because when you learn from the past history, you are making sure that it won't repeat itself again. So education is key. So I encourage young people to educate themselves, and also to also make sure that they learn to take care of themselves, to love one another, and appreciate life. So, and to me, that would be a message I would give to the young people. And also to another thing that I will say, I always say to people, especially for the things we have gone through, never lose hope. No matter what horrible circumstances you may face in your life, never lose hope. Mm-hmm. For losing hope is the beginning of your own self-defeat. So I will probably leave that message to everyone.
Powerful message. Constance Nishimwe, thank you so much for taking time to chat with us today on The Voice of America.
Thank you so much for having me.
A 30th Kwibuka event was also held in Washington, D.C. My colleague Lionel Gahima was there and has this report.
The ceremony held at the Embassy of the Republic of Rwanda was attended by the embassy staff, leaders of Ibuka, an umbrella organization that connects the group that aids survivors of the 1994 genocide against the Tutsi and members of the Rwandan community in the DMV area. The flag flew at half-mast in solemn remembrance. Embassy officials say that this event holds great significance as they honor the memory of those who lost their lives in the genocide. Kathy Riga, president of the...
That when you look at Rwandans, what they had to give up, you know, to shrug their shoulders and keep moving forward after the experiences that they had to go through in the 1994 genocide against the Tutsi. It's a journey that even I can't fathom as a human being. But when you look, you just see that humanity, when there's a will, there is a way. And I believe that the need to survive on behalf of those that could not survive, I believe has been the story of Rwanda. So really, to those, you know, that are not with us, I believe when they look upon Rwanda, they will be proud that they're trying and continue to try and keep pushing forward. So that, for me, 30 years means that to me.
Alain Chouty, a civil engineer, is the commissioner of youth for the Rwandan Community Organization.
We meet today for the 30th time, not only to commemorate, but also to always remember not only how we got here, but also to make sure that it never happens again. I myself, talking, I'm a genocide survivor. When the genocide happened, I was only 6 months. This is a generation that just happened. Without RPF, I wouldn't be here. So it's very important to always remember, to unite, and also renew our vows to make sure that this never happens again.
Throughout the day, participants engage in various remembrance activities, such as lighting candles and laying flowers in solemn tribute. Shiba Rugege Hakiza is an entrepreneur, and she serves as the U.S. Rwandan Community Treasurer.
For my family, it's always a solemn day. We lost an unspeakable number of Rwandans, friends of Rwanda, on the beginning of the genocide, April 7, 1994. But what it also signifies to us is that we are a people who are resilient. No matter how tough the situation, we were refugees in Uganda when I was born. We continued to persevere.
Ian Manzi from Georgetown University is a member of the Rwandan community.
So I think that, first of all, for the next generation, the young that are going to carry this on, it is important for us to understand that our history, however painful, however dark it is our own. It is to own that history, to understand that it is part of who we are, but then that it's not everything that we are. We are able to say to the world that we've moved from that and we're able to build something that's valuable. So that's the first thing that we need to learn. The second thing is that the truth must remain the truth no matter what, that we have to be mindful that genocide is not complete until you get to the stage of denial and revisionism. So the biggest battle that the young generation has to face moving forward is to maintain the authenticity and the truth of our history.
As the day came to a close, many participants say that they were living with a renewed commitment to honoring the memory of the genocide victims and fostering unity and reconciliations in their country.
This is Upfront on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Now, as social media continues to inspire and motivate more people to travel and visit new destinations, it also poses challenges that travelers, influencers, and the travel industry must navigate responsibly. Nigerian-born Lola Akimade Akastrom is an award-winning travel writer and National Geographic photographer known for her work promoting sustainable travel and cultural exploration around the world. Lola is also a novelist, and her new book, Everything Is Not Enough, is a follow-up to her debut novel, In Every Mirror She's Black. She has been praised for creating multi-dimensional and complex characters. A day after her book launch, I caught up with her to talk about the concept of Instagram tourism and how to balance the need to capture those beautiful images and photos while encouraging responsible and ethical travel practices. Lola, thank you so much for joining us. Talk to us about how you started, what inspired you to pursue these careers.
Absolutely. So great to be here. I actually started in the IT field, right? So before I became a writer and a photographer, I was a programmer for many years, but I'd always had that passion for travel. I've always loved to write. My first love was actually fiction when I was a teenager growing up in Nigeria. So I wanted to get back to that more creative side of myself. And so it was in 2002 when I volunteered with an expedition race in Fiji. That was when I started getting a taste of what it was to be a travel writer, because my job was to write about the expedition, write about the places we were visiting in Fiji, and send daily dispatches. And it was that moment, I remember it clear as day, that I knew that I wanted to be a travel writer. And then the photography kind of came on.
Came in on later.
Because that came on later, yes.
And they say that behind every programmer is a creative waiting to come out. So I guess you on your creative side. Now, as both a writer and photographer, what would you say is the most effective medium of storytelling?
I think it depends on the story you want to tell. Because sometimes, and that is why I feel grateful as a storyteller that I can choose whichever medium based on what I want to say. So sometimes we need the verbosity of words to describe a place so you can feel it. Sometimes just a photo looking into the eyes of someone is enough to tell the story. So it really depends on what story you're trying to tell. And then for me anyway, is when I say, okay, maybe a photo essay might tell this stronger, or maybe just writing really descriptive, immersive words can convey it better. So it really depends on what story you're trying to tell. The platform comes second.
You're just telling me that you had a book launch yesterday for your new book, new novel, Everything Is Not Enough. We were not going to talk in detail about it, but would you describe it as a sequel to your first novel, In Every Mirror She's Black?
It's actually a follow-up, right? Because some of the same characters are in both books, but it can actually be read as a standalone book. So it just continues the stories, the lives of the women from the first book, but it can actually be read as a standalone book. So that's why we call it a follow-up.
Got you. I figured a little bit that might be along those lines. Now, you have a unique background. You were born in Nigeria. Where did you grow up in Nigeria?
In Lagos. I grew up in Lagos.
Now you reside in Sweden. What would you say, how would you say your cultural background has influenced your work and perspective on travel and on writing?
Absolutely. So I am a Yoruba. That's my tribe. And Nigeria, we've got over 250 different tribes speaking over 500 plus languages and dialects. And so from a very early age, I was very sensitive to the nuances of culture, because we have to live together. We have to acknowledge each other, respect each other, and make space for each other. And so that natural empathy for different cultures is what I carried into travel writing. And that's why I really love getting beneath culture, really understanding the nuances of why we're different and why we need to be different and what connects us, our similarities. And so moving to Sweden was just an extension of that, and why I've spent a lot of time really, truly getting beneath Swedish culture in my work as well.
Mm. And I read that your work focuses a lot on sustainable travel. Why is that important to you, and how do you incorporate that in your photography and your writing too?
So I always say sustainable travel, but more slow travel. And what I usually say is, you know, it's all about the pace versus the duration. Because how quickly you move through a place, it takes time to develop relationships. It takes time to really fully appreciate. And so sometimes when I'm traveling through a place, I just pick a theme and say, you know what, I want to get this, to know this place deeper based on its food culture. I don't have to see the big sites, but if I go deeper through one theme, that's a more sustainable way of travel. You appreciate the place more, you gain deeper expertise and insight into that place based on, exactly, you immerse. And so for me, that's one thing, but also making sure that the local communities are fully involved in the decision-making process, in that whatever you do does not disturb values, tradition, does not
disrupt, disrespect,
so that's super important. So you have to travel with purpose and intention, and that's what I do. I'm a big advocate for that,
which we've seen a lot in this Instagram travel era, but we'll get to that a little later. But give us some tips on how you select your destinations and experiences to feature in your work. Are there any specific criteria that you use when choosing what to showcase?
Yes. So there isn't really any, you know, set criteria. One, it depends on if I'm on assignment. So a publication already has the destination they want to cover. But personally, I am interested in tradition. I am interested in people that work with their hands, that are preserving tradition in a more modern way, you know, because when you work with your hands, it forces you to slow down, to be intentional, to be in the moment, to not be distracted. And so that always pulls me in terms of the work. I love culture. I find different cultures super fascinating. So I always love experiencing culture through subcultures, lifestyle, tradition, and the slow gastronomy. So for me, those are the themes that really interest me. And then that is what steers the direction of the destination or the communities I spend time with.
And I imagine that takes a lot of planning and preparation and research. So let's again talk about this changing landscape of travel, yes, the ever-evolving landscape of travel and technology. How do you stay relevant in your field, adapting to these changing technologies and industry?
So I always say that people should not worry about staying relevant, but worry about the next evolution of themselves as a storyteller. Mm-hmm. So my work as a travel writer is not to always stay relevant. I am aware of trends. I use the technology to sharpen my voice, but I don't get swept up by trends or by technology in terms of trying to stay relevant. As a storyteller, what you can do is make sure that you're using the modern tools to make your voice stronger. And what you have to do is find your voice first and then worry about how that voice is evolving over time. And so when we think about Instagram tourism, you know, where people just go to destinations and use them as backdrops, that could be the trend now. But I call it, it feels like cotton candy versus solid food, right? You know, and so I am in the business of the solid food storytelling.
Right.
And that just builds organic longevity.
Absolutely.
You know, because you are worried about how am I evolving and growing as a storyteller.
And those who know the solid food will know where to find it.
Exactly. Yes. Yes.
Again, in this age of social media and Instagram tourism, like you called it, how do you balance the desire of capturing that beautiful image with the need to promote responsible and ethical travel practices?
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, there is that balance. I think one of the things is making sure that local voices are involved in that storytelling, right? Because people want to be presented a certain way or a different way. Yes, destinations are beautiful. They have to be captured. But what's happening around the destination? How are people, or, you know, around that landmark, how are people living their everyday lives? Why not also capture, you know, all of that? You know, one of the photography tips I always say is, if you see a landmark, actually just ignore the landmark and capture everything around the landmark. Keep the landmark relegated as a backdrop, so you can see how people are living their everyday lives in the shadow of this, you know, icon or landmark. So that is the way I go about my storytelling.
You're listening to Upfront on The Voice of America. We're chatting with acclaimed travel photographer and writer Lola Akimade Akerstrom. She just released her second novel titled Everything Is Not Enough. But today we're talking mostly about her travel photography. The intersection of travel and social media raises many ethical considerations, and Lola advises on how to strike that balance between sharing experiences and respecting the cultural sensitivities of local communities.
I think it is, don't photograph what you think others want to see. Photograph what you truly are interested in. Because once you, and that's how you can start developing your own voice, mm-hmm, as a photographer, as an artist, as a writer, focus on what naturally and organically draws your interest, right? And not, oh, I want to work with National Geographic or whatever, so I must shoot that way. Then you become a dime a dozen. Mm-hmm. And that is what I always say. Your journey might be longer to get where you need to go, but by the time you get there, it's uniquely yours. Your voice has not been watered down or changed by others.
And with that, we come to the end of our show today. Many thanks to our guests. Remember to connect with us at voaafrica.com for more on our programming. You can connect with us on our social media platforms at VOA Africa. Our show is at VOA Upfront. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Have a great week ahead, Africa.